Blue Dot, Episode 2, Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem, along with co-host Matt Schultz. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Dave. I like to think of myself as assistant host.
We'll have to negotiate that.
Talk to my union. Talk to my union guy.
You definitely assist me. Co-host, assistant. Maybe we should, you know, have a contest and let our listeners decide whether you're the co-host or assistant host.
I have a better idea. Let's just talk about
what we're going to do with the show today, because otherwise it could get really bad. We're going to be talking to the bad astronomer, Matt.
Phil Plait.
He is the bad astronomer, and he is probably the one person I can think of that knows almost everything there is to know about astronomy and can present it in a really fun and interesting way. And we'll get an idea from him about why he calls himself the bad astronomer. And his Twitter feed is one of my favorite things to follow about all things going on in space and life and just fun things in general. He's a really interesting
and
guy.
And on Earth. And he's one of the really early adopters of Twitter as a serious vehicle for promoting science and promoting his own thing that he's had going on.
Yeah, and we'll find out how he's become part of the YouTube revolution of communicating science that's going on right now. So let's talk to Phil Plait, the bad astronomer. He joins us from his home in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Phil.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, I'd like to start out with you are a real astronomer. I'd like to know, let our listeners know about your background. What were some of your bona fides when you first got into astronomy before you started doing all the media stuff you do now?
Yeah, I've been fascinated by astronomy since I was a little kid, and I mean like 5 or 6 years old. And I was pretty sure that's what I was going to do my whole life, and it was. I wound up taking classes in high school for math and science, same in college, eventually going to graduate school and getting my PhD using Hubble Space Telescope observations of a star that exploded. And this was literally when Hubble launched. I took this project on just weeks before the telescope actually went into space. So I was actually right there when we launched it and found out that the mirror wouldn't focus. So that was a fun time for a couple of years with the out-of-focus data. But eventually, they put in optics to correct that, and I wound up getting a job after I got my degree working on Hubble more, helping calibrate a camera that went on board called STISS, the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph. Worked on that for a few years, worked on some educational stuff, actually. I kind of decided I wanted to talk about astronomy more than I wanted to do research in it. So I wound up joining a group in California where we developed educational activities for students about astronomy, and then eventually kicked out on my own to write the blog, write books, give talks, and make TV shows about astronomy. And I'm just as happy as I could be. This is what I want to be doing.
You became quite involved as the bad astronomer and bad astronomy in addressing the moon hoax. How did that first get started for you?
Right. This is the idea that NASA faked the Apollo moon missions, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it's just right on the face of it. It's just a ridiculous claim. But as we've seen over the past, 5,000 years, a lot of ridiculous claims, a lot of people really buy into them. And sometimes the more ridiculous they are, the more they buy into them because that's just proving the conspiracy. There's no arguing with people like that. But it's not a bad idea to at least have a resource where you can go and find out what the facts are. And I knew about the moon hoax idea, in the late 1990s, I guess, and I'd run into it a few times here and there. Then I started really fully getting into it when I wrote my first book, where I wanted to write a chapter about this whole thing. Right around that time is when Fox TV aired a TV show called Conspiracy Theory. Did we land on the moon? And it's like, well, yes. The answer is yes, but that would have been a very short show. So, of course, they went into all of these ridiculous claims. At the time, I had a website, but the web wasn't huge in 2001. But still, I put up a web page basically going through each point, debunking it. You know, here's why the shadows don't look parallel. Here's why it looks like they brought lighting equipment when they didn't. There's just all these claims that sort of sound okay until you really look at them, and then you're like, oh, that's ridiculous. And that page went viral for the time. I had never experienced anything like it. And it really kind of launched my career, which gives me really mixed feelings about the moon hoax theory because I hate it. But on the other hand, I owe my career to it. So,
well, you did a great job of debunking that. And one of the things that, you know, I always tell people as a physics teacher is like, I can show you things in the videos from the moon, from the television broadcast that show you there's no way they could not be on the moon. If you look at, for example, the little projectile motion of the regolith flying off their boots and going in these little ballistic arcs forward, you know, on the Earth, they wouldn't do that. You know, the moon is so different from the Earth. Or watching the flag, which they claim waves, it actually has pendulum motion, which is what you would expect, again, to find on the moon. So, yeah, I love the fact that you did that.
Well, thank you. And yeah, you're right. The beauty of this is that you can teach science starting with this, I guess you'd call it anti-science. And this idea that, for example, like you said, that the dust on the moon, instead of just billowing up around their boots when they would run around, because there's no air on the moon, it would go up and then come back down. And it makes these beautiful parabolic ballistic arcs. And it's amazing reading the moon hoax ideas about this because they somehow think the moon doesn't have gravity. They say, look at the dust going up and coming back down. That couldn't happen on the moon. It's like, wait, what? The moon has gravity. You can see that because the astronauts are walking around on the moon. So if your problem is that the dust is coming back down, but you don't have a problem with the astronauts coming back down, you have a bigger problem than thinking the moon hoax was the moon was landings were fake.
You've got a pretty poor understanding of physics if you're there. Well, let's move on to happier things. But
sure.
Before we do, how did you come up with the title? I know the title of the book was Bad Astronomy.
Yeah, that was actually my website before the book, and it was sort of an informal name for a long time. Basically, it was because I started off, when I started doing sort of this public outreach of talking to people about astronomy, I started off talking about myths and misconceptions about astronomy. The first one I ever did was why we have seasons, and this old idea that you can stand an egg on end on the first day of spring. And it turns out, no, you can stand an egg on end any day. It has nothing to do with the seasons. But that's a good way of teaching people why we have seasons. And from there, it just grew and grew. I called it Bad Astronomy, and then it just was sort of a tongue-in-cheek joke to call myself the Bad Astronomer.
And it stuck.
A lesson to everybody, be careful what you call yourself because those names will stick.
Okay, let's talk about what you're doing now. You've got part of the Crash Course series on YouTube. You do Crash Course Astronomy. How did you come into that?
I'm still really excited about that. Last year at Comic-Con, I was approached by my friend Derek Muller, who does the Veritasium science video series on YouTube, and he said that he had been talking to Hank Green. Now, Hank is a YouTube megastar. He and his brother John, who is a best-selling author, they do the Vlogbrothers video series and a lot of other things. And they have done this Crash Course series on chemistry, on history, and all these other things. And they wanted to do an astronomy one. So they wanted to get somebody who had outreach experience and astronomy experience. So they talked to Derek. Derek talked to me. I talked to them. And we wound up making an agreement to do it. And it's been fantastic. It was a huge amount of work. I was kind of stunned by the workload, but it was 46 episodes.
And for people who haven't seen them, give us an idea of the outline structure for the series.
Well, the idea was to sort of mimic a class in astronomy. So if you took a high school or college introductory class, you'd first learn about the motions of the sky, and you'd learn about the planets, and then stars and galaxies, and then cosmology, the eventual the birth, evolution, and fate of the universe. So we followed that arc, put together a basic syllabus, hung some ideas on it, and then got to it. So you'll find episodes on each of the individual planets, asteroids, comets, and a lot of it is fairly cutting edge. In fact, while we were writing it, the Dawn spacecraft was on its way to Ceres. And so I didn't actually have the best images that we have now of Ceres. New Horizons had not yet passed Pluto when I had to film the Pluto episode. So basically I said, well, here's what we know about Pluto, and all of this is going to change in a couple of months. So I'm not going to go into too much detail. And that's kind of how we did it.
I would like to talk about your use of social media. You have a really active presence on Twitter. I follow you. And how has that been something that you've used to enable you to communicate science to the public?
Well, it's not something I set out to do. It's not like I thought, I'm going to become somebody very popular on Twitter and use it to promote myself. It wasn't like that. I joined up. I actually get people sending me notes sometimes like, wow, your Twitter user number is so low. I got on not long after it started, less than a couple of years, I think. And it was just another social medium. And at the time, Facebook was getting started. MySpace was still popular. Orkut was around. I could name a bunch of social media that are dead and gone now. At the time, I'll tell you the truth. At the time, there were a couple of people who didn't like me much because I would debunk stuff, and that makes you enemies, basically. And they would go anytime a new social medium would pop up, they would try to spoof me and get a name like mine and secure it before I could. Squatting is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And so whenever a new social media would come up, I would grab it really quickly. So I heard about Twitter, so I jumped on it, got the Bad Astronomer, or just Bad Astronomer is my handle. And that was why I went on Twitter, really. And I didn't think it was much use, but over the few months that I started, I realized, oh, this is actually really good. I can link to stuff, I can talk about stuff. If there are events that are happening live, you can talk about them as they happen. And it's just grown. And now I found that, you know, there are people who just tweet science. They're science communicators, and that's what they tweet. Or they just tweet personal stuff. With me, I do both. If I think of a funny joke, I'm going to tweet it or a picture. I do it the same thing with Instagram or any of the other social media, really. It's, you know, I love science. It's a part of my life. It's something you can't really separate from me. And so when I get on social media, when I do public outreach, yeah, it's me. It's my personality. And that's, I think, because I'm enthusiastic and passionate about that, I think people like that. And so, it sticks. And it's worked out great.
This might be a good time then to ask you a couple of personal types of questions, and then we'll talk about movies in a moment. But I just like to, one of the things that bothers me about people in general is we all tend to view each other as, you are an astronomer, and that's all you are. And I get that a lot. You know, the people, like my students, I'm a high school teacher. I teach high school physics and earth science and astronomy. My students ask me all the time, do you just go home and, like, do science? And it's like, no. In fact, when I go home, I tend to not do science as much as possible. So I'd like to just kind of unpack your personal box a little bit to know what you're like. So I got a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
If you could spend a day with any person at all, and it could be a person living or past, a person that's gone, who might that be? Who would be somebody you would love to spend a day with?
Probably River Song from Doctor Who. You didn't say it had to be a real person.
No, I didn't, so that's fine.
Wow, that's a good question.
And why? Why River Song?
Because I just think she's awesome. Okay. I'd probably get killed hanging out with her because she seems like a dangerous person, but it would be an exciting day. I have led such a charmed life that I have met a lot of the people who have inspired me, whether that would happen to be scientists I've worked with or scientists I've admired or writers, science fiction writers, actors. It's been just a crazy past few years of meeting all of these people I like,
not to mention the astronauts that you've met.
Yeah, that's also been amazing. Ron Guerin and Chris Hadfield, and a few others in the past too. It's been fantastic to go, and mostly I'll say this is through social media like Twitter and science fiction conventions like Comic-Con. So you never know at Comic-Con who you're just going to bump into. And it's like, oh, my gosh. And And then you wind up hanging out with them, and it just winds up being a fantastic time.
If you could go anywhere, and with you, I'll let you go anywhere. Normally, I'd say on Earth, but anywhere you want to go. You can spend a day anywhere you'd like to be. Where would you like to go?
Saturn. Yeah, that's easy. I'm not big on strapping myself in a rocket and going anywhere. I get sick on a kid's swing set, so it's not like I want to be in free fall. But if I could have, you know, the USS Enterprise with artificial gravity and go anywhere, you know, a lot of these places, if you went up close to them, a nebula or things like that, they wouldn't look like much because they're spread out so much. They wouldn't be as bright and as beautiful as they are in pictures. But Saturn would be all that. I would love to see those rings up close, not just from far away, but to actually see their structure and travel in them and see the ice particles that make them up. That would be, I think, any astronomer's dream.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear more from Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer, about science and the movies. We'll be right back. You're listening to Blue Dot. We're back talking with Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer.
Okay, let's talk movies. You do a great job of, like, looking at, you know, what sometimes things that are not quite right in movies when it comes down to the science in them. And some of that stuff is, you know, it's part of the Hollywood thing. But I'd like to talk about some of the recent movies in the past couple of years and get your take on them. Let's start with, I'd like you to discuss Gravity, Interstellar, The Martian, and then we'll finish with that movie that just came out that's very popular that made a lot of money.
Oh, The Revenant?
No. No, the one that's set in space in a galaxy far, far away.
Far, far away.
So Gravity and Interstellar, how about those two?
Yeah, these are interesting movies because they were very popular. You know, these were box office hits, and they were based on science, which is really awesome. I love it when the public gets into the science as a story, because science is a story. It's our story of how the universe works. And when you put people in the middle of it and put and you see the drama of it, that's wonderful. Gravity is an interesting flick because if you ignore the orbital mechanics, it's a great movie. But, you know, the basis of it, you know, spoiler alert here, is that a satellite explodes and then the debris spreads out and hits other satellites and then they collide and you get this basically runaway cascade of destroyed satellites spreading debris all over the place. That, in fact, can happen. There are studies on this. It can't really happen that catastrophically as it does in the movie, but it can happen, and so it's a concern. The problem with the movie is they start on the space shuttle going to Hubble, but then they go over to the space station, and then they go to a different Chinese space station, and these are all objects in extremely different orbits. And it's not like you're just driving along the highway and you stop at a rest stop someplace. It's not like that. These things are moving in different directions at high velocity. So it's more like if you wanted to go from the space station to Hubble, it would be like driving in a truck and you drive over an overpass and you want to jump onto a car going under that overpass. And it's like, well, if you do that, you're going to slam into that car at 60 miles an hour. You actually have to change your direction and then match velocities with that thing, and that takes a huge amount of energy. So that part of the movie was, like, grossly wrong. But, you know, ignore that. What you've got is a really tightly scripted, fascinating human adventure that had me on the edge of my seat. And a lot of it was really well done, how things looked, the feel of it, what she had to do in the Chinese spacecraft, which was modeled after a Soyuz. That all worked. I mean, they actually used some trivia from that rocket, that spacecraft, that is true, that she had to use and know to get it working correctly. So I was actually pretty happy with that movie, despite its errors.
Okay, how about Interstellar?
That's the exact opposite. I actually really, 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 really did not like Interstellar. And I will say that the black hole physics was fine. If you want to talk about time travel, again, spoiler alert, I thought actually the time travel aspects of the story at the end were shown really well. It was visually really interesting, and I liked it. I just didn't care for the story. I thought it was too long, too drawn out, too implausible. A lot of stuff happened it didn't have anything to do with the plot. There was just a lot of stuff slapped together in that.
Okay, two thumbs down recommendation there. And as far as spoilers goes, yeah. You know, as far as these movies have been out a while, so like if you haven't seen them out there, then you know you have too much of a life. So you know that's just the way it goes. Now, how about The Martian?
I really enjoyed it. Again, here is a movie that has pretty decent science in it, and let me be careful here. In the book is way more into the engineering and science aspect of it than the movie was. But still, in the movie, science is critical. Engineering is critical to what's going on. But it's still a story about people that you kind of like. Even the guy running NASA, who's the closest you get to a bad guy in the movie, and even he is just doing what he thinks is right. It's not like he's twirling his mustache thinking, I'm going to be able to save money by killing Mark Watney. It's not like that at all. He thinks he's doing the right thing, making a tough decision. So it's all about the interaction between the people and what they can do to get Mark Watney home. As implausible as the idea is, it's a great feel-good movie that really showed in a lot of ways what smart people can do when they get together and do smart things.
And what did you?
I like that.
What did you think of the visual representation of Mars?
Oh, it was fantastic. There were some things that, if you look carefully, it's kind of like, oh well. But the scenes in the desert, the hills, the way the landscape was set up, really to me looked like the pictures we get from Curiosity and from the orbiters taking images from space of Mars. I thought visually it was a stunning movie.
Okay, and what about the new Star Wars movie?
I liked it. I'll put this right out there. I'm not a big Star Wars fan. I'm a Star Trek guy, but I like the Star Wars movies. I enjoy them. You know, it's not like I hate them or anything like that, but I've seen all of the movies up to this last one, and I just saw the last one a couple of days ago. And I thought it was great. I thought it was way better than the prequels, and a worthy successor to the first three movies. I'm really digging the new characters. I like what they've done. The special effects were fantastic, and I'm very curious to see where the next two will go.
Let's shift gears. And finally, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your interests in the future of astronomy. What do you think is like some of the most interesting topics to you personally as far as solar system astronomy goes? What are the big questions you'd like to see answered?
This kind of question is funny because what always happens is you always wind up saying whatever's on the cutting edge of what we're learning right now, because that's where all the cool stuff is. And right now there is a lot of cool stuff. And the bottom line in that is water. We are discovering water everywhere. Now we knew that comets were made of water. We knew that some of Jupiter's moons and some of Saturn's moons, these outer moons in the solar system, very shiny, very reflective. So they must be made of water ice, have a lot in them. What we weren't expecting until relatively recently is that water might be liquid under the surface. So now there's a huge amount of evidence of an under surface ocean on Europa. We have direct evidence of this on Enceladus, Saturn's moon, because of the plumes coming out of the South Pole. And now we're starting to see more evidence of this in some of the rockier ice moons like Ganymede, because of the way they rotate, the way these moons behave. And it's looking like there's liquid water, you know, all over the solar system. It's a little nuts, but we don't have a lot of information about it yet. So the idea that NASA is going to build a probe to Europa, normally this early on in that sort of thing, I would be like, well, you know, we'll see. But this has a lot of momentum, and it's looking good to get this thing built and sent to Jupiter to actually orbit Europa and possibly drop a lander to take a look up close and see what is inside Europa. That's about as exciting as anything I can think of right now with solar system research.
It is exciting. And we're about out of time. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today. But
no time for Matt's question?
Before you go, we have to get Matt's question. So, Matt, what would you like to know from Phil Plait, bad astronomer?
Starting with you taking on moon landing deniers, then following along with a lot of the things you talk about in Bad Astronomy or on your Twitter, it's like there's almost this battle between people who decide their truths based on feelings and people who decide on things based on facts. And you're this champion for the facts side. Does that sound right?
No, you're exactly right. That's a good, a very good point, and that's something I've been consciously trying to do. We've learned over the years that simply throwing facts at people is not going to change their mind. If somebody believes that the Earth is 6,000 years old, you're not going to convince them by showing them radioactive isotopes or continental drift or anything like that, because they know about that stuff. They believe in this for other reasons, and so you can't find that wedge into them by simply throwing facts at them. And this is something I've been saying for a long time. It's the same thing with people who think that vaccines cause all kinds of problems as opposed to simply curing diseases. And that's why I try to show my passion, to show my emotional investment in some of these things, especially something like vaccination. And I go into that because it's the easiest example. I have my full course of vaccinations. So does my wife, so does my daughter. So when I write about vaccinations, I can say there was a Dutch study that showed that this vaccine doesn't cause autism, and there was this other study that shows this and that. That's not going to sway people. When I say I have my vaccines, my daughter has her vaccines, here's a family I know whose child got deathly ill because they didn't get their vaccinations, that is going to sway somebody way more than any study I can quote. And I think that's the thing that science communicators are arcing toward now, is this personal story. It's not just simply describing Saturn. It's basically saying, look at how gorgeous this is. Look at what this is telling us about ourselves. That's how you get into people's brains. It's how you get into their hearts. And I think that's where the real treasure lies when it comes to communicating science.
Well, in our next episode, we'll just have Matt ask his question, and I'll just go hang out at the bar and have a beer, because that was great. Hey, thanks, Phil. I really appreciate your time, and you were wonderful. I enjoy following me on Twitter, and the Crash Course series is great, and just wish you all the best this year.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck with this new podcast. This sounds like it's going to be really great.
Blue Dot's a production of North State Public Radio. Visit us at mynspr.org. Check us out on Twitter at @NSPRNews. Follow me at @Dave Shlohm, and I am reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.